I'm going to say some, start off with some remarks whose length I cannot predict with any great accuracy, but hopefully will not test affect it too much. I usually like to start off by looking at stuff that's in today's paper. And today, there's a few things in the New York Times I noticed which were kind of interesting. One of them was about the continuing discussion around John Kerry's new stand. And I just thought I'd make one comment about that, which is I think it's a very positive thing that John Kerry is talking about setting time frames for withdrawing from Iraq. I think that's a positive kind of thing to put into the debate. I don't think it's a terribly positive thing to describe what's going on in Iraq and what the invasion and so on as a mistake, which is what John Kerry has described it as. I mean, a mistake is a morally neutral category. And what happened with the invasion of Iraq and what's happened with the occupation should not be described in morally neutral terms. What's happened, Britain and the United States carried out a crime of aggression, and we've compounded that with a whole set of other crimes that were committed against the Iraqi people. And right now there's another story about things quietening down at the moment in Ramadi, which, as I'm sure you all know, is kind of encircled and being besieged. Oh, I wonder how this comes over on the audio. Okay. It's being besieged, and it says there's a lovely line at the end of the article. I don't know about you, but I always skip to the last couple of paragraphs in any story because that's often where the most interesting things are. Last paragraph of the story is, still, both the American and Iraqi military seem to leave the door open for stepped-up operations in the future. There is currently no plan for a large-scale operation in Ramadi, General Jassim said. I don't know about you, Webb, but whenever I hear someone say, I have no plans at the moment to do something, I get very frightened about what they're going to do next. There was a very interesting editorial in the New York Times today, which is based on a cable which they've got hold of from the US Embassy in Baghdad, giving a little snapshot of what the Iraqi employees who come into the embassy have been saying. And probably everyone's read this, but it talks about highlights employees running a daily gauntlet. Oh, they stopped the gauntlet. Okay. Daily gauntlet of religious dress code enforcers, harassment by militia style security guards, etc., etc. Ethnic cleansing is going on, etc. And then, kind of at the tail end of all of that, a Sunni woman employee reports that most of her family, is the quote, believes that the US, which is widely perceived as fully controlling the country and tolerating the Malays, is punishing populations as Saddam did. So, that's just a remark in passing. But I think that when we look at what's happened with cities like Fallujah, when we look at the assaults that have happened since Fallujah, when we remember what Saddam did in northern Iraq to the Kurds, Kurdish areas, and the devastation of towns and cities in that region during the Anfal campaign, then I think that is not an entirely outlandish comparison. Okay, well, I'll make some remarks about this book. The reason I wanted to... There were basically two reasons I wanted to write this book. One of them was that after the attacks in July last year in London, and as I'm sure everyone here knows, there was a set of attacks on the 7th of July when four young men blew themselves up on the underground on a bus, and then on the 21st of July, four more young men tried to carry out these similar attacks, but their explosives didn't work out because they hadn't got the preparation quite right. In the aftermath of those attacks, there was a wealth of information that came into the public domain that was really important for us to have a rational debate about the crisis that we're in and the threat that we're facing. And what would happen to that information is that it would appear and then it would disappear as though it had never been. And there's one very dramatic example. One very dramatic example which comes from the Observer, which is the connected to the Guardian newspaper now. And so on the 2nd of April, the Observer had a front page story on the right hand side there, which says, official Iraq war led to July bombings. Okay? And this referred to a report which had been compiled by a senior Home Office official who had been asked after the attacks to compile what was called a narrative of the attacks. Now, when that first happened, we didn't know what the narrative was going to be. Maybe it was just being a chronology. Muhammad Sadiq Khan went to Leeds on the 6th of July. On the 7th of July, he drove, you know, we didn't know what it was going to be. But according to this story, because they got the first draft of this narrative, in that first narrative, it went further than that, and it has a section on radicalization, how these young men came to think the way they did. And it says, there's a paragraph 5, initial drafts of the government's account into the bombings, which have been revealed to the Observer, state that Iraq was a key contributory factor. That's a quote from the report. The references to Britain's involvement in Iraq are contained in a section examining what inspired the radicalization of the 4th British suicide bombers, Sadiq Khan, Asif Hussain, Shehzad Tanweer, and Jermaine Lindsay. The findings will prove highly embarrassing to Tony Blair, who has maintained that the decision to go to war against Iraq would make Britain safer. Now, the report didn't come out immediately after that leak. What was really bizarre was that the following week, on the 9th of April, the Observer again had a front page story. Leak reveals official story of London bombings. And then the subheadings, Al-Qaeda not linked, says government, gang used internet to plan 7/7 attack. So you can tell from the title and the subtitles that this has got a different focus. Now, when you read it, and it's by the same journalist, Mark Townsend, the crime correspondent, this is the next edition of this newspaper, what you discover is that this story is a report about the same draft narrative which he had reported about the previous week. But on the front page, there's no reference to the foreign policy dimension, which had been the headline last time. If you want the foreign policy dimension, it's on the second page in the last paragraph. According to the report, the attacks were largely motivated by concerns over foreign policy and the perception that it was deliberately anti-Muslim, although the four men were also driven by the promise of immortality. So what was the headline and the main story has become half of the last sentence. It's the same report, the same journalist, the same newspaper in the next edition. Now how that came to be, I don't know exactly what the mechanics of that are, but that was a particularly dramatic illustration of a phenomenon which happened time and time again. Now, when the report was finally published, as could have been predicted, and as in fact was predicted by me, if no one else, that set of reference to Iraq had been removed, and the talk about it being a contributory factor had been removed, and stuff about foreign policy had been downgraded to this kind of language about concerns and things like that. It was all very fuzzy. So, and they removed the word Iraq, which very clearly was in the first draft. And that phenomenon happened again and again and again. And so, for example, on the 10th of July, 3 days after the attack, which killed 52 people, at a time when we didn't know who had carried out the attacks, the Sunday Times newspaper carried again a front-page story about another government report, which was leaked. And this was a joint inquiry by the Home Office, which is responsible for domestic affairs and police and so on, and the intelligence services, and the Foreign Office, joint report with intelligence input, called Young Muslims and Extremism. Now, within a few days, the question of how young Muslims could be attracted to extremism had become the topic in British society. This was the burning topic last summer. How can young men who have been raised in this country, who enjoy the rights and privileges of British citizens, three of them born in Britain, how could they end up blowing themselves up in a random selection of commuters in London? So you would have thought that a government inquiry into this topic would be material to that discussion. Well, there, in the course of the whole year, I think there were, apart from that Sunday Times report, I think there were 5 references to that report over the whole second half of the year. And the Sunday Times didn't pick it up again. The Sunday Times put that draft report, Young Muslims and Extremism, on its website, and you can still find it there. But the reason why it wasn't picked up was the same reason why the Observer changed the story here, because it made a connection that ran directly counter to what the government and respectable opinion was saying about these attacks. Because in that report, which had been, the first draft was compiled in early 2004, it listed the factors which it believed were attracting or driving young Muslims in Britain towards extremism, i.e. support for terrorism and political violence and so on. And the first factor in their list was foreign policy, British foreign policy. And then it gave Islamophobia, and then it gave, and in Islamophobia it included perceptions amongst British Muslims of the way that counter-terror laws are being used against Muslims. So Islamophobia wasn't just, you know, white non-Muslims having bad attitude, it was about institutional Islamophobia as well, or perceived Islamophobia as it's written in the report. And then it's got cultural stuff and, you know, feelings of power, etc. But the number one was foreign policy. And in fact, in the executive summary, it summed up the report's conclusions in 3 words. And the first word was anger. And when they explain what anger means, they explain it means foreign policy. And just to pick out one thing in the foreign policy section, this government report said that before 9/11, the perception amongst British Muslims was that British foreign policy, as it impacted on Muslims around the world, was one of passive oppression, which is to say, not really caring too much about what's happening to the Muslims in Chechnya under Russian oppression, not really getting too fussed about Muslims in Indian-occupied Kashmir, not standing up to Israel about the plight of Palestinians, and that kind of stuff. You know, in my words, malign neglect. And the report said that after 9/11, the perception changed to one of active oppression, with the invasion of Afghanistan, the invasion of Iraq, and the other ways in which Britain has become involved in George W. Bush's war on terror. This is great, actually, because we're still in the standing room only category, because there are still some people standing. See, we've got to manage the number of seats so that you can always go home and say, standing room only. So, you know, if anyone leaves, hold up their chair. maintain our status, okay? Don't undermine me. Okay. So that was what the British government's own inquiry into the topic of young Muslims and extremism said. And that directly contradicted the line that the government was taking. in the middle of the summer last year. So that was of enormous significance, and that report did not feature in the media today. And there were some of us who were trying to get it recognised, but it did not make it into the debate. Now, I should say in passing that, as I'm sure everyone here is aware, and Tony Blair is a master of words. He is the greatest presenter in the world, probably, in terms of presentation. So he never actually denied that there was a connection between the 7/7 attacks and the war in Iraq. What he said was, when people said to him, you know, come on, there's a connection, isn't there? He would say, what he'd say is, when you say there is a connection, you are helping the terrorists. Now, he hadn't said there's no connection, he's just saying, you're helping the terrorists. And then when they say, well, look, you know, there's some connection, isn't there? Then the second attack would be, but these attacks have been happening before in 1998 in East Africa and 9/11 before the invasion of Iraq. So he implied, but he didn't say, that it was just a coincidence that this attack happened after March 2003 rather than before it. Now, he came under enormous pressure in the British media, and the pressure was because there were opinion polls which showed the majority of people in Britain thought there was a connection. So there's one poll in The Guardian which found 64% of people thought there was a connection. There was another poll that found 85% of people. Dad's trying to get us to down. There's no one. Okay. He doesn't count. Okay, right. There was another poll in the Daily Mirror which found 85% of people in Britain thought there was a connection. There was a poll for the Greater London Authority which found only 8% of Londoners agreed with the government that there was no connection. The huge majority of people instinctively made a connection between the attacks in London and the war in Iraq. And then there were reports, there were leaks from British intelligence. There was also this report from Chatham House, which is the Royal Institute for International Affairs, which is like the voice of the establishment, saying there was, you know, that the war in Iraq had contributed basically to the problem of terrorism in Britain. And he was under enormous pressure. So finally, towards the end of July, he was backed into a corner where he said, well, in the long run, we're safer because of the invasion of Iraq. And you see, the next stage was he was going to have to be forced to admit that in the short run, we were not safer, and that we were actually in more danger. And in my view, perhaps, I haven't actually encountered anyone else in Britain who said this, but in my view, that is why he chose that moment to bring out his panoply of repressive laws, you know, deporting people to torture states, locking them up for 90 days without charge and so on. And suddenly the whole debate changed as of the 5th of August when he made all these remarks. So we were no longer talking about, you know, is there a connection? We were talking about how dare he rip up our laws and go against the European Convention on Human Rights, blah, blah, blah. Totally different debate in which Tony Blair looked good because he was saying, I am standing for the people's safety. All of these, you know, human rights people and judges and people are getting in our way, and we made it as a battle between him and the establishment. He being anti-establishment, and the establishment being these fuddy-duddy people who you know, think that locking people up without telling them why they're locked up for 90 days was a, you know, they just couldn't get it. So, anyway, to get back to my point, there was a lot of information that was coming out, and that's some of it, which I'll kind of discuss now, which was coming out, disappearing, in the typical mainstream media way, and I thought that it was important to collect that stuff together so that people who are fighting against the propaganda would have kind of a compendium and tool, which is kind of why I wrote War Plan Iraq in 2002 for a similar reason, to give people who want to fight propaganda a kind of handy collection rather than having to get all these web pages and whatever together. That was one reason. The other reason was I was really moved and also troubled when I was reading about survivors of the attacks and relatives of people who died, who were saying things like, I'm reading the Quran, I'm reading about the Middle East, I'm trying to understand why this happened. And the reason I was troubled was that we're all seated. Okay, right. The reason I was troubled was that I think that saying I want to understand an act of terrorism, I'm going to read the Quran, it's kind of like saying I want to understand Hiroshima, I'm going to read a quantum physics book, textbook, you know. It's like you could use quantum atomic physics to build a bomb, sure, you could do that. You could use it to make some kind of CT scan or whatever. I don't know exactly how what they need to do. I think you could use it for some kind of health purpose. You can use atomic physics to help make some stuff that we use in everyday life, just by kind of getting by every day, something that's useful. Or you can just admire them as kind of beautiful equations, something beautiful. I think that's the same with every sacred text that I've ever seen. You know, you can pick bits out of it to use for violent purposes. You can pick bits out of it for human welfare. You can use it just to help you get through the day, which seems to me how most people use most religion. Or you can just kind of admire the text as something, you know, beautiful, if it strikes you that way. But thinking that you can go from the Quran to any particular act carried out by a Muslim, which they say is based on an interpretation of Islam, I was very troubled by that, and I was very troubled by the surge in Islamophobia, which there was in Britain after the attacks. So there was a poll in the Daily Telegraph which found that the proportion of people in Britain who believe that Islam as a religion, not extremist Islam, not fundamentalist Islam, not Al-Qaeda Islam, but Islam as a religion is a threat to liberal democracy, increased by 50% from just after 9/11 to just after 7/7. And now it's running out, well, last summer it was running out about 45%, which if you strip out the don't know, it's about half the population. And it showed that the same poll found that the proportion of people who believe that Islam as a religion is a serious threat to liberal democracy has doubled since 9/11. And last summer it was running at 20%, 1 in 5 people in Britain. Now I find that really frightening. Now, you know, in Britain you find a lot of Muslim commentators saying things like, this is like the 1930s in Germany and it's kind of, we're heading down towards some terrible things. I don't know whether that's true, it doesn't seem entirely right, but we're not so far away from it that I can say that I find it myself to say that's completely scaremongering. To have 1 in 5 people in the country having that kind of a view of Islam and therefore of all Muslims, I think is deeply worrying for the future. And so I think it's incredibly important for non-Muslims. I'm a non-Muslim. I come from a Hindu background. I'm wearing a shirt that says, Muslims say peace be upon you, which is just a statement of fact, as I'm sure most of you know. Because when Muslims greet each other, they say, Salaam alaikum, and then say back, alaikum salam. So they think we can do that now. And that means, peace be upon you, be peace. So I'll say, Salaam alaikum. Okay, great. We just greeted each other halfway through the whole evening. Okay, well, I should have done it at the beginning. Okay. So this little badge and is part of a bunch of different things that my group is doing to try to combat Islamophobia because that seems to be a really big problem. Anyway, what I wanted to do, apart from addressing issues around Islam, and there's a section here about Islam and, you know, is it inherently violent and so on. If you want to talk about that, we can talk about that further, which I think is really important. But what I wanted to do was I wanted to write a book that would hopefully give a coherent explanation of what had gone on and which survivors and family members would feel respected their experience. And that's what I try to do. And I'm really glad that, you know, some survivors have read the book and they've said to me that they did feel that, you know, it gave them an explanation and it did respect their experience. So from that point of view, I know that at least for some of the target audience, you know, it was successful. So those are two of the main reasons why I wanted to write the book. And just to kind of finish off talking about what's involved in that, I thought it was really important to also combat this myth that became almost a standard language for talking about the bomb. To try to examine all the publicly available evidence about these four young men, and to see if the standard way of talking about them really held up, which was they were brainwashed. Their friends said they must have been brainwashed. Their family said they must have been brainwashed. You know, I would talk to just people and they would say, I just don't understand it. They must have been brainwashed. And so, just to end, I mean, we can go into what we know about these guys in more detail in the question and answer. But brainwashing is about, well, classically, the classic phrase is milieu control, which is you kind of segregate people and you control what information they're getting and you kind of put pressure on them in various ways. And in that somewhat secluded atmosphere, you can warp people a bit. And that's what brainwashing is. What happened with these guys is they weren't secluded. You know, two of them were, well, one of them was still living with his parents, which is Carol living with his parents, right until the night before he took off down there to London. One of them was living with his wife, he stood up shortly before the bombings, one of them had split up a little bit earlier, but they were living in the community. They weren't in some Al-Qaeda commune, kind of being bombarded and harassed and emotionally manipulated. They were out in society. One of them was working in his father's shop. One of them was working as a teacher's assistant. They were just out in part of society. They weren't brainwashed. The message of Osama bin Laden was not something that they were subjected to. It was something they sought out. And that's the real puzzle. Why would nice young men, this is the most frequent adjective used about them, he was a nice guy, he was a nice young man, he was a nice neighbor. Why would four nice young men be attracted to this message of hatred and travel down the road, which ended up with them killing 52 people? And hopefully, in the course of the next hour, we'll come to some explanations which at least some people find satisfying. But I think with that, I'll terminate the unidirectional part of the evening and turn it into a multi or at least bi-directional phase now. So, Dan, are you coming here or what are you going to do?
I thought first I would pass the bus to the back.
Oh, okay, fine.
It will be split among Peace and Justice Works, Doc, of course, and Milan to cover his travel expenses. And that the books are available over here for $20, and there are buttons too. And then I guess I can come up here and help you pick people to speak, and that would be helpful.
All right. I didn't see the power over there.
Ooh.
But these chairs are still up.
Really? Are there still people there?
Oh.
All right, so if anybody wants to go first with a question or
raising your hand.
Yeah.
I'm struck by your description of what brainwashing is, because it occurs to me that that's what our government is trying to do to us.
Well, that leads very naturally into the Noam Chomsky, Edward Herman, brainwashing under freedom thesis, their propaganda model of the media, which I'm sure most folks here are familiar with. And so you can achieve milieu control either by separating people physically into some kind of little commune or little, some kind of little hidey hole and then doing this stuff to them. And the classic examples where this whole discussion about brainwashing, the word brainwashing comes from, is in the Chinese revolutionary experience of what happened to students in universities and the foreigners who were being held basically in prison, and the kind of intense segregated indoctrination that they were subjected to. But if there are no other messages out there in wider society, then yeah, you can, I mean, you can achieve milieu control without having to shove some, lock someone up in a cell. If you can somehow limit the milieu and the messages which are reaching people without having to put someone into a particular holding facility. And so we have this paradox where the United States and Western countries in general have reached a very high level of internal freedom, have a very high level of free speech, and the US is way ahead of every other country that I know in detail in terms of free speech, have a huge level of free speech, and also an incredibly high level of indoctrination. And that you can only resolve by saying that there are some mechanisms which are working to constrain thought other than physical force, other than the threat of violence, you know, other than the standard kind of humiliation and so on, the standard kind of brainwashing techniques. And so the Chomsky-Herman model is that the mass media, and in fact beyond that, academia and right across the intellectual culture, what Chomsky says is that the mass media is just the easiest part of the intellectual culture to study, is constrained by a number of different mechanisms, one of them being the fact that in the mass media, we can go into more, in more detail, but in essence, the mass media is a free market in ideas. And in a free market, those who are most wealthy buy the most stuff. And so the ideas which are favoured by the wealthy are the ones which will predominate. If you are a wealthy owner of a paper, I mean, you know, this is just to take one small aspect of it. If you're a wealthy owner of a paper, then you will select to be your senior reporters and columnists people who don't challenge your position. And obviously it's much more complicated than that. But and then you get a process of self-censorship, which is, I think, what happens here. You know, self-censorship. I don't think the government told the Observer to do this front page stuff. I think you have a process, or very indirectly, I don't think they gave them a direct order. You have a process of self-censorship, and it's a process of self-censorship which we're not even aware of most of the time. So we can go into that in more detail if people want to pick up on that. But certainly, I think brainwashing under freedom is a very real phenomenon.
I think I saw better than the other question.
Well, when 9/11 happened, the same with the bombings in London, there a lot of people, especially on the left, made the claim that, well, this is a result of our foreign policy. It's just the CIA puts in its blowback from those three, four exploitive type policies, especially by maybe corporations, but in league with the government, federal government, U.S. government. How do you really prove something like that? I mean, it's like a very generalized statement. And you're talking about cycle, you know, people's inner mind, you know, can't read people's minds, but, you know, except for Bin Laden, which, you know, he's made it clear that he's especially protested what he is objecting to as far as Western governments. But, you know, I still don't see how that can be used as a basis for making a claim that it's all a fault of our foreign policy that we get this reaction of hatred.
Okay, just in case there are people in here, that was saying that the claim was made after 9/11 that the attacks were a response to US foreign policy, and that's quite a general claim. How can it really be proved? And
the individual.
Yeah.
We went their mind.
Okay, how do we know what those people were really thinking? And I think that one of the things that I was trying to do in this book was, as I said, to collect together hard information. And I think you're absolutely right. Simply to give your opinion is of no value. Because if someone has a different opinion, and you say, well, this is my opinion, all you've got is two opinions in the room. You haven't got a basis for persuasion. So, for example, if I was trying to persuade someone that the Al-Qaeda campaign was about foreign policy, and they were firmly convinced in the other direction, if they were convinced by George Bush and Tony Blair that Al-Qaeda is attacking us because of our freedom and our democracy and feminism and so on, then where I would start with someone like that is I would say, well, have you heard of a guy called Michael Scheuer? Michael Scheuer ran the CIA's Bin Laden unit from 1996 to 1999. Now, as you all know, the CIA has stations. It has the Beirut station, the London station, and so on. But in 1996, they created the first non-geographical station to track and neutralize Osama Bin Laden. And Michael Scheuer was in charge of that unit. And so he retired last November, and so he is one of the CIA's, and therefore the Western intelligence's, top experts on Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. And he's written two books, one called Through Our Enemy's Eyes, and the other called Imperial Hubris. And because he was still in the agency at the time, they're listed as anonymous with the author, but now we all know that it's him. And in those books, he makes 100% clear, and he says in terms, George W. Bush says this, a whole load of commentators say this, it's about freedom and democracy. They are wrong. That's not true. This is about our policy. So if I was trying to persuade someone, I would start with that and say, well, you know, I am a left-wing peace activist, I've got an opinion, but here is a guy who is a rabid, right-wing, Republican reactionary guy who, if he could blow up all the terrorists in the world, he would do it tomorrow. If we could do it that way, he would do that that way tomorrow. And he is quite up for a long war against, you know, all of this stuff. You know, much more. One of the reasons why he fell out of favour in 1999, he was kind of moved sideways from the Bin Laden unit, was it because he wanted more aggressive action against Bin Laden, more attempts to take him out, more attempts to take down Al-Qaeda leadership, and the political leadership at the time were not as gung-ho as him, and so on. That's the kind of guy we're talking about. So what I'd say to someone is, well, you know, it's not my opinion, it's Michael Scheuer. Michael Scheuer says what he's calling for is a national debate in this country, and I guess this goes for Britain and other countries as well, a national debate about this crisis, about this threat, in which we look at the various policies which are driving this campaign, we look at the costs which are associated with them, and we make a decision, UK-US debate, we make decisions about whether we want to continue with those policies. And he says, at the end of that national debate, we may decide, you may decide as the United States, yes, we're going to carry on down this path. We're going to carry on with the policies as they are. And he says, if that happens, at least we'll have made a democratic decision in the light of all the facts, and we will go into this war with our eyes open, knowing that it will be long, it will be bloody, and it will cost us a great deal. And so, you know, he says that what he says is that Bin Laden, and you know, as you say, we know a lot about Bin Laden, and this is a particularly useful compendium of Bin Laden's statements, which have been translated and checked by this guy called Bruce Lawrence, who's a US academic. Messages to the World, the statements of Osama Bin Laden. I felt a little bit nervous about carrying this through customs into the US. And, you know, it's Osama Bin Laden's been very, very clear. And what Michael Schroeder says is, I'm not sure I would use these words, but what Michael Schroeder says is, Bin Laden is a genius at selecting what he mobilizes around. Ayatollah Khomeini, you know, he was like, oh, pole dancing, Hollywood, miniskirts, you know, decadence, right? And that's what Ayatollah Khomeini was you know, fulminating about. What Shoya says is, Bin Laden does not focus on things that offend Muslims around the world. He focuses on things which make their blood boil. Muslims being killed at the hands of the West or at the hands of regimes backed by the West. And that's what Bin Laden focuses on. Now, you know, there's something which both Dan and I have been involved in, possibly many of you have been involved in as well. One of the things that Bin Laden uses to mobilize is the experience of Iraq under the sanctions. And I've seen video, you can find it on the internet, where Bin Laden is talking about the economic sanctions in Iraq. He's talking about the hundreds of thousands of children who died under the economic sanctions in Iraq. And there are tears in his eyes. And I have no doubt as to his sincerity about that. I have no doubt that he sincerely feels grieved about that. And what he says is, and here he's just speaking fact, really. What he says is, the Western powers, which is basically the US and UK, imposed these sanctions on Iraq, even though it was, you know, via the modality of the UN, but the US and UK are the ones who kept driving it on year after year. They imposed these sanctions on Iraq, they killed hundreds of thousands of children in Iraq. Who cared in the West? There was barely a flicker of concern until 1998, okay? And they don't care about killing our women and children. Why should we care about killing their women and children until they stop? And that's basically Bin Laden's message in a nutshell. That's what he says. He said, talks about Chechnya, talks about Palestine, he talks about Afghanistan and Iraq, and it talks about a range of issues. And his basic message is, they are torturing us, killing us, raping us, and so on. We are justified in doing the same thing to their civilians, and it's a mode of making them stop. Now, I think that's immoral, I think that's criminal, I think that's completely unjustifiable. What happens though, is that there are people in the world who feel angry and who feel intimately connected to Muslims around the world, who feel the suffering of Muslims around the world as if they are their brothers and sisters who are suffering. Now, in the case of these four young men who carried out the 7/7 attacks, we know a bit about them. And what we know is that they grew up pretty reluctant Muslims, and when they were teenagers, they just drifted completely away from their family culture, Pakistani heritage culture, Islam. They weren't interested. Muhammad Sadiq Khan, who was the lead bomber, he organized this whole thing, he came to the US on holiday, and he came back raving about the US, wearing cowboy boots, saying, I want to emigrate to the US. Okay? All of these guys went through this phase in their teenage years. So how did they end up doing this stuff? And Muhammad Sadiq Khan left a video behind in which he said he was, following the footsteps of Osama bin Laden, and what he said was, you are gassing us, you're killing us, and as long as you're shooting and raping us, we will attack you. This is a war, I am a soldier. And those are the terms that he used. When he talked about gassing, incidentally, it's probably a reference to an incident in Thailand, where the Thai authorities threw a bunch of Muslims into the back of a van, closed the doors, and didn't open them. And when they opened them, I don't know how many people, there was over a dozen people, I think over 20 people, dead, but they suffocated in there. And a local Muslim cleric said, it's like gassing them. And I think that's where this gassing reference comes to. And it's an indication of how Muslim suffering around the world becomes put together into one shape. And so the logic of the argument is, we're hurting, they're attacking us, there is a conspiracy against us by the Christian crusaders and the Jews. We're starting, you know, we make the leap from factual reality that Muslims are hurting, and very often it's at the hands of the West or Western-backed regimes, and then turns into this paranoid vision of there is this global conspiracy against us, and then it leaps the kind of the moral boundary to say whatever has been done to us, we are justified in doing to them. So what we know about these four guys is that, according to their friends and people who knew them, their radicalization took off when they started, when there was an Islamic bookshop started up in Leeds, where three of them lived, and they started watching jihadist DVDs, which showed massacres in Chechnya, which showed people suffering and being humiliated and so on, and killed in Palestine. We showed all of this stuff and had these exhortations to do something to defend the Muslim brothers and sisters. And that's when it started. And we know that, for example, well, there's a whole bunch of things to say, but we know that, for example, Muhammad Sadiq Khan, some people in him said you could not actually have a conversation with this guy about the invasion of Iraq in 2003. He would not be able to converse with you, he would just kind of erupt, and it would be that you couldn't have any discussion about it, he would just blow up. And so there's a whole bunch of different things we know about them which kind of add to the picture, but the basic picture is we know quite a lot about these guys, and we know that in their teens they were as un-Islamic as you could get, and then by 2001, 2002, they started following this path, and they sought out these DVDs, they sought out these websites, they sought out these discussion groups, they sought out and made for themselves a little group which did things together, like, you know, military games and out-of-bound adventure, trekking stuff, and, you know, kind of training themselves. They sought that out. No one forced them. Osama bin Laden didn't force them, Tony Blair didn't force them. They sought that out because it made sense to them as a response to what they saw around the world. Doesn't make sense to me, but it made sense to them. So we know quite a bit about those guys, and I think, I haven't done a detailed study, but, and there are other British suicide bombers who are also discussing this, but who we know quite a lot about, and time and again we find the same thing. We find the same things being said by them about defending, this was how they felt they were defending their people from the West and Britain, British foreign policy in particular. So yeah, we know quite a lot, I think, about these psychologies. We can't read minds, but I think we have enough evidence to make a plausible picture. No one can say with 100% certainty, but I think there's a plausible picture that can be made out of the available evidence.